Welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast, a podcast incorporating narratives about facing and navigating adversity, a mixture of people, their experiences, and professional psychological discussion. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn-Tirillo. I'm a qualified and regulated psychologist with over 20 years' experience of mental health, disability, and human behaviour. I want to share people's stories of navigating adversity in the hope that through being heard, a dose of compassion and some understanding, we can help others in the face of adversity too. Hi, and welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn-Tirillo, and today I am super thrilled to have a guest that I was brilliantly able to meet in person last year at a wonderful mental health and poetry event. So I have Major General Tim Hodgetts. Would you like to say hello, introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about who you are and what's brought you on today?
Well, hello, Tara, and thank you very much for inviting me. Yeah, my name's Tim Hodgetts. I am a retired Major General. After 41 years of military service, I retired from active duty at the end of 2024, but I do still remain what's called Master General Medical and Colonel Commandant of the Royal Army Medical Service, which sounds a very fancy title for a leadership role that the Army no longer pays me for.
Okay, that you're doing philanthropically. Because of the person that you are. Your background is incredible. So you have a book out called Frontlines and Lifelines. I will put all the information of this in our show notes. This is how I met you, because you were talking about poetry in medicine at an event. But also prior to that, this book has a wonderful history of you and your career. Can we just delve into a little bit your journey? Because that in itself is probably another whole podcast episode.
Yeah, so yes, I've had a career of serial traumatic events and major instance disaster has sort of followed me around, but it also drew me in into that specialism. And my first experience came very early in my career, just 2 weeks after I had qualified as a young doctor in 1986. Wow. I know, long time ago. I was with my family in a car on a Sunday evening, driving back home on a country road in Yorkshire. We lived in a place called Bramhope, and we came across a road traffic accident, and we were the first at scene. It was a mini metro that had driven into a telegraph pole. Very dark road, 1986, it's before mobile phones.
Yes.
So I had to send my parents off in the car to try and find a telephone box while I stayed with my sister at the scene to look after the four casualties. And there were two teenage girls in the back who were dead. The front seat passenger had a minor head injury and a concussion, but it was the driver who had my attention. He'd managed to get himself out of the car and was sitting propped up against the stone wall, and even in the moonlight I could tell he was very seriously unwell. And he'd had his arm out the window when he hit the telegraph pole and taken his arm off above the elbow, so he was bleeding to death. He's what we call circling the drain. He was in the sort of last moments of life unless something was done to stop that bleeding. So I improvised a tourniquet using his belt and had to keep that pressure on, or keep it tight, for quite some time, because it was a country road location. It took about half an hour for the ambulance to arrive, but he did survive. And 2 years later, he went on to win his first gold medal at the Seoul Paralympics. Now, that taught me quite a lot, or I took away a number of lessons from that, some of which I didn't really realize at the time, but became important later in my career. One was that tourniquets do work, and even improvised tourniquets work, because in the early noughties, I introduced tourniquets for every soldier to carry around as part of their individual first aid kit during the Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns. At that time, I was the defense professor of emergency medicine and the defense consultant advisor of emergency medicine. So I was able to influence what first aid we taught to the soldiers, and indeed what equipment that they carried. But it also gave me a nudge very early in my career towards pre-hospital care and emergency medicine. But it transpired, and I'd been a medical student in the army, and I was now heading off to my military career. It transpired there was no accident and emergency, or emergency medicine as we now call it, within the army. So I went off down a path of general medicine, internal medicine. I started training in cardiology, and I found myself out in Germany in 1988 to 1990 as a junior physician. And at that time, the IRA were very active against British soldiers as part of British Army of the Rhine. So there were drive-by shootings outside some of the military hospitals. There were drive-by shootings at the Channel ports when people were going home on leave. And there were two car bombs in the street adjacent to where I lived. So we were all down on our bellies every morning checking under our cars for car bombs. And at that time, a telephone warning came in to the hospital. What we used to call coded warnings. In other words, certain words were used which authenticated that it might have been the terrorists, so we took it seriously, and we evacuated the hospital out onto the football pitches, and that included everybody from the hospital, even the young soldier who had been having his appendix taken out. He woke up from the anaesthetic looking up at blue sky, thinking he'd gone to heaven. But when we took everything out the first time, because we did it more than once onto the football pitches, we didn't take any equipment with us to look after casualties because we hadn't planned for that. So I then thought really hard, well, what would we need to take with us if we had to do that again? And then put all the equipment together in boxes and the mobile oxygen cylinders so we could actually have a treatment facility out on the football pitches. And running in parallel at this time, the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh set up the Diploma in Immediate Medical Care. And although I was in general medicine, I thought, I want to do this diploma. So I did the diploma in its first year back in 88 to 89, and I actually got the gold medal for that. But there were no revision notes because it was a new exam. So there's no book that you could read to prepare yourself for the exam. So I thought, well, why don't I turn all these little cards that I've written and collected into a box, into a book? So I wrote my first book, 1989, and published it in 1990 on a £30 Boots typewriter, doing all my own drawings. And those drawings included three exercises: what to do in a train crash, a plane crash, a terrorist bomb, and how you would sort these casualties into priorities for treatment, and what the treatment would be. So I'd thought a lot about pre-hospital care, and I'd been doing some teaching at the local university in Hanover, the Medizinische Hochschule, and I'd been teaching pre-hospital care at weekends, and it was very, very popular. So I'd been teaching, I'd been learning, I'd done this diploma, I'd written a book, and it turned out to be really sort of salient mental preparation for the day that changed my life. Right. Which was the 2nd of November 1991 at 3:53 in the afternoon during the England versus Australia Rugby World Cup final, when I was the medical registrar, the physician, in the military wing of Musgrave Park Hospital in Belfast. And the IRA blew up the hospital, specifically targeting the doctors and the nurses. They put the bomb against the fire door, or the fire escape door, of the underground social club, the basement social club, where the off-duty doctors and nurses were down watching at the match. Now, fortunately, I was about 100 yards away when that bomb went off. So I was first at scene, but I wasn't in the room when the bomb went off. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be here today to tell this story. But given I'd had all this training and experience in pre-hospital care, even though I was junior in rank, I became the medical commander at that particular scene and organised the sort of temporary treatment facility in the road, the casualty clearing station. But we had no we had no equipment, so I had to go into the burning hospital, partly to evacuate the existing casualties, which I did, but also to go into the destroyed intensive care unit, the destroyed emergency department, and try and get some equipment to bring it out into the road. Now, this military hospital wasn't a full hospital. It was what we call a military wing. So it was a small sort of footprint bolted on the end of a civilian Colt referral hospital. It didn't have an A&E department. But I got the civilian doctors and nurses to come out with the cardiac arrest trolleys from their wards. And we used the cardiac arrest trolleys as the equipment and drugs for each little treatment bay in the road. Now, if you can imagine, we've got a bomb that's gone off at a hospital. Part of that civilian hospital had a children's ward, and the windows had been blown out of the children's ward, and the casualties are either patients or doctors and nurses. So the call that goes out for the emergency services is, there's been a bomb at the hospital, children's ward's affected, the clinical staff are affected. And it was the largest ever emergency service response in Northern Ireland up to that particular time. Everybody came. I mean, it was a massive response. And we sort of cleared the casualties and the incident. It took time to dig people and bodies out of the wreckage, because the ground floor had collapsed into the basement where people were trapped. And I looked at my watch, and, you know, 5 hours had gone by in a flash. What you find in disasters is that time can either be compressed or can be really stretched. You know, I was so busy, it was compressed. And I looked and I thought, oh my goodness, I need to phone home. I need to tell my wife, who had actually visited one weekend while I was posted out in Northern Ireland. So she knew the sort of the layout. But how do you phone home? Because one of the first things that would happen in any security incident at that particular time is that the landlines would be cut. They'd be disrupted. You wouldn't be able to phone in or out for security reasons. But the house that I was living in back in the UK, back in London, was a military house. So it had a separate phone system. So it had a military telephone line as well as a civilian telephone line. So I was the only person that could actually phone out through the military telephone system rather than the civilian sort of BT telephone system to pass a message on to my wife, who was extremely surprised to hear me. And was already being supported in my home on the assumption that I'd been killed. Because on the news, it was that the bomb had gone off in the officer's mess. And she knew what the officer's mess was. Yes. And it wasn't the officer's mess. It was actually in the hospital, in the social club. But the presumption was, because I hadn't rung and passed any information on, that perhaps I had been killed.
The worst that happened,
And then once she's getting over that, I said, oh, and can you pass a message on to other families, because nobody else can make a phone call.
So, it's pre-mobile phones as well in those days as well. Yeah,
absolutely. So that really did cement me in terms of pre-hospital care, emergency medicine, disaster medicine. And I was nearing the end of my sort of 5 years of time after qualification, where you either sign on or you go off and do something else. I said, well, I'd quite like to stay, but there's no emergency medicine. I don't want to go off and do emergency medicine. And we had quite a visionary general back there, a guy called Major General Jack Cool, who was the director of Army Surgery. And he said, well, if you're the first person to train in emergency medicine in the Army, will you stay? Yes. I said, yeah, absolutely. So off I went to Manchester for a couple of years to start with, to do higher training. And while I was there, I had this sort of real burning passion inside me to turn that experience into something positive. Yes. And you know, I have absolutely learnt later in my career that this is post-traumatic growth,
where
you turn something difficult into something positive, and I've serially done that throughout my career. But I turned that experience together with friends and colleagues in Manchester, so sort of co-senior registrars in Manchester, into the MIMS course, Major Incident Medical Management and Support, which teaches doctors, nurses, paramedics what to do at the scene of a major incident, irrespective of its nature. And those principles cross the civil military boundary, they cross international boundaries, and it very rapidly became the international standard and remains that today. And it's the NATO standard as well. We've developed a sort of a military stylized version of the course so that the exercises within it are military contextualized, but the principles are exactly the same. And that has been very effective, and I've really enjoyed taking that around the world, setting it up across Sweden, Netherlands, Italy, and other countries besides. It's translated into Japanese. The book looks really pretty. I have no idea what it says, but it looks great. And that sort of pushed me down this disaster medicine interest area. And in my deployed career, I have dealt with a lot of multiple casualty incidents. And because I have a system, because I created a system, it's just got easier and easier, because you use that that system to overcome the sort of cognitive paralysis that you can get in a really traumatic incident, a situation you may be very unfamiliar with. But if you know where to start and you get your mind working, then away you go. And of course you've got to adapt, because every incident is slightly different. And the plan won't exactly fit.
Yes.
But the plan will be good enough to get you started and give you that confidence, which you can then it then rubs off on others. If you stand quietly and calmly, others will come to you, and it's right, just line up one at a time. I've got my clipboard. I'm going to write down everything that I say, because it gives me a mental pause before the next one. Otherwise, everybody will just surround you and ask questions. But nope, one at a time. Let's just calm it down, quickly you can turn chaos not to order, but at least to mild confusion, and that tends to be good enough.
I get your kind of psychology. Look at that, like reducing the threat mode enough. I guess kind of the metaphor, just getting your head above water to go, right, where am I? Where's land? Where's the boat or whatever? What do I need to do next?
Yes,
because we know, don't we? Logical, clear thinking when we're full of adrenaline and cortisol kind of goes offline. I think the thing that has really interested me about your career is how you've also taught other people to press pause, to be considered, to take the time to check in, because as human beings, we're doers, we're in threat mode, we're in do mode. Often people get stuck in unhealthy habits that way and don't revise systems. And
I think another sort of example at the individual patient level is I introduced a way of handing over a patient from the ambulance service to the hospital, into the emergency department. It's called MIST, mechanism injury signs treatment. Now we did after a couple of years of introducing it, turn it to at MIST, and we had age, time of injury, then mechanism injury signs and treatment. And you can pass that over in 20 seconds or so. So in comes the ambulance crew with a seriously injured patient, and unless CPR is in progress or there's an obvious obstructed airway, which you can hear because the patient will be snoring or making the sounds that they can't breathe properly, unless those things are present, everyone can stop, listen for that 20 seconds to the handover. And then everybody has a common understanding of what's going on, because otherwise in comes the patient, everybody goes hands on, the paramedic's trying to shout out the handover at the background and then disappears. And then 5-10 minutes later, they turn around and say, what did the paramedic say? Did they say they had any morphine? How much fluid did they have? And it's lost.
Yes.
But just that pause, everybody get on the same page. clear handover, and it respects the paramedics who've been looking after the patient perhaps for almost up to an hour in some cases for an entrapment. We've got their story, and then the scribe nurse can take them off to one side and make sure we've got all of the details written down onto the trauma.
Which matter
trauma
as well.
It really does. When you come to improve care, I set up the system of trauma governance for defence. It's another story. I can tell that story. But ultimately, when people say what really made a difference to the improved outcomes of the injured soldiers that we have been able to prove in the sort of 10 years, 1999 to 2009, we were able to prove this improved outcomes. And what was the one thing that makes the difference? Well, it's the data. That if you've got that really high quality data, which includes the information that's passed on of what's gone on in the pre-hospital setting, then you can look back and you can compare what went well, what didn't go well for each patient, and then we can actually sort of move forward on an evidence-based footing. And if I just tell that story about trauma governance, because it is what made the difference to the outcomes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and will continue to make the difference for future conflicts. But as my last year of higher training, I went to Australia. Hard life, someone's got to do it. And I spent a year as a trauma fellow at a major trauma centre in Sydney. Now, originally, they sold me a pop because I thought, Sydney, I'm going to be able to see the Opera House and Sydney Harbour. I was actually 20 miles outside Sydney in a suburb where all the trauma happened, a place called Liverpool. And it was a very, very good trauma system. We did not have that system in the UK, which is why I wanted to go to Australia, which was a regional trauma system. We only introduced regional trauma systems in 2012. Wow. In the UK, but this was back in the early 90s or mid 90s that I actually went and experienced this in Australia. But what they did was they collected a lot of data and they fed back to the peripheral hospitals about how they could improve and what they were doing well to reinforce good practice. So I get back to the UK, and this is 1995. I'm starting as a new consultant at Frimley Park Hospital. I think, well, how do we get that system into the UK? It took me 18 months to get the money and the people, but I set up the same system that I'd seen in Liverpool Hospital in Sydney in Frimley Park Hospital in Surrey, which was an affiliated hospital with the military. So it's what we called at the time a Ministry of Defence Hospital Unit. So there's a whole bunch of people in uniform working in the NHS, and I was one of them. And what we were able to do by very aggressive audit, and by aggressive, I mean, you know, we really went after the detail, and we insisted that people attended the audit meetings if they wanted to be on the trauma team. And we had video review of our trauma calls so that we were constantly learning on the dynamics of the trauma team and getting better and better. And we proved that in the first 3 years that I was measuring it, each year our outcomes got better and better. And in fact, we were recognised by the NHS as a beacon hospital. Nobody else was doing it. Then I went off to Kosovo, and I took an emergency department for the first time on a military operation. Up to 1999 in Kosovo, there had never been emergency medicine deployed. The rest of the hospital had just sort of managed it, that if it was a resuscitation, the anaesthetist would do it. If it was a medical case, the physician would do it. If it was a surgical case, the surgeon would do it. But there was nobody cohering the front end doing emergency medicine. So I took the department, and I also took a trauma nurse coordinator and said, we're going to collect exactly the same data that we were collecting in Frimley Park. And at the end of this operation, we will compare it, because the assumption was that we could not be as good as the NHS. We had never before collected this data. We assumed that you couldn't achieve the same outcomes in a tented field hospital that you could in the NHS. In fact, it wasn't a tented field hospital. We'd set the field hospital up in a former children's prison just outside the capital, which is as gruesome as it sounds.
Yes.
but we collected the information and compared it, and to our surprise, our outcomes were the same.
Wow.
Now, we did better in some areas and not as good in other areas, but the balance was that our outcomes were the same. And this was a penny dropping moment.
Staggering, yeah.
That we can be as good in the field, which meant, well, if we can be as good, we can be better, because we can build from that. And that's exactly what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, that because of the weekly audit and the pace of change, and the fact that we were holding to account people on our weekly case conferences, that they had to try and resolve the issue by the time of the next case conference the following week, we just accelerated so fast, and we had a strategic drift away from the NHS in terms of our outcomes. And we were able to prove, and it's published, that our outcomes got better and better every year from 2003 through to 2012, while the injury severity got worse. So it was a double whammy. You're dealing with more severely injured and your outcomes are better. And it was 2009 when the Healthcare Commission, which is the precursor to the Care Quality Commission, they came out to Afghanistan. We invited them. They weren't obliged to come, but we said, well, come and have a look. And they did a report, and they said that the management of your seriously injured is exemplary. And I don't believe they had ever before or ever since used that descriptor of an acute hospital or an ambulance service. And they said there's much that the NHS can learn. And I think, I believe, and I know, that that was the real catalyst to the development of major trauma centres in the UK, because we had the military experience. We could prove that if we were a regional trauma system, that's what the military was. It was from point of wounding through to rehabilitation in a single system. And it meant that the rehabilitation doctors could actually influence what was being done far forward, because they were seeing the results of what you had done a couple of weeks ago in their rehabilitation centre. So, well, if you do it slightly differently earlier, it will make it easier for us. And so the whole system could inform itself. I think if I was to have a legacy, it would be the major trauma system and the system of governance that was able to drive continuous quality improvement and produce a cohort of unexpected survivors, people who by all mathematical probability should be dead, but they are not. They are alive.
So, big, bold question. So the thing that resonated me when I heard you first talk and from reading your book and actually some other bits of your work is the impact then on the humans that are dealing and seeing the trauma.
Yes, absolutely.
Other soldiers, because of this innovation and managing even your own trauma, if that's all right, to bring in as well, because you're seeing outcomes that wouldn't have been the same, but also whether those processes also help your own ability to deal with what's going on and what you're seeing and absorbing.
So I often say that in a field hospital, we see people who are having their worst day. When you're stood on a landmine or being exposed to an ID, it is going to be the worst day of your life. But at the field hospital, we are seeing everybody's worst days all day, every day. Because they all come and converge on a single treatment facility. So yes, it does take its toll. And also dealing with soldiers in uniform who are injured is really quite different to dealing with somebody you don't know who's 85, 90, who's come from a care home in cardiac arrest. Yes, of course, you do your best, but you don't have that same personal connection as somebody who's wearing the same uniform, lying in tatters on the stretch in front of you, and often really quite young people. You know, these are 18, 19, 20 year old people. So we do feel it really quite intensely. And the unity of purpose within a field hospital is extraordinary. You know, when the message comes through that there's a seriously injured soldier coming, the whole hospital revolves around that. Yeah. You know, people literally run to the front, wait for the blood test, run off with the blood to process it, run back with the results. Everybody is trying to do their very best for those individuals. And I've been the medical director of a field hospital on six of my tours, so that the senior doctor, including in a multinational field hospital where half the hospital was Danish, a quarter American, quarter British. And the difference, of course, in that is your isolation. I mean, yes, command is lonely, but actually you've got geographical isolation. You're out in the middle of nowhere. Yes. There's no going home at night. Who are your peers? Who can you actually talk to? There might be a very small number of people that you can talk to, another senior clinician, the padre, the commanding officer, but it's a pretty small group of people that you can bounce off. In terms of family support, well, you might have a phone, you might not, and certainly on some of the early entry tours I've been on, it has literally been blueies. So airmail letters, and you get a response to that letter 2 weeks later. So there's no sort of dynamic phoning your spouse up and having
absolutely things that you would do if you were in A&E and you're going home after shift. Things that we do for our well-being, our mental health.
Yeah,
all those protective factors
it's
are not
dry. It's dry tours, so there's no going down the bar and having having a drink.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist. So you have to find ways of coping.
Yes.
And you know, I found a number of ways of coping. I mean, partly it is your training and your experience, and we train very hard before we deploy as a complete hospital. We have a hospital in a hangar in York, and we put it through its paces in the 5 days immediately before you deploy for validation, and you work them really hard, and you're looking at individual performance. So that's through micro simulation. Can you do this skill? You're looking at team performance, the trauma team, the cardiac arrest team, that what we call the CCAS team, the critical care air support team that will come in to take a patient back on the aircraft as an intensive care patient.
Yes.
You're looking at the massive transfusion team in the lab, and you're looking at the hospital management team. You know, are they actually managing the whole hospital, fighting the whole hospital, rather than just individual patients? So we train very hard, and that allows you to think about a lot of the ethical issues in advance, because the place you do not want to have an ethical discussion is over the patient, because then you're going to default to your sort of normal NHS perspective, which may not fit in a deployed operational or indeed war situation. So you need to think about these things in advance. Have decided what you would do if you come across this type of problem, and then it is so much easier when you are in the real-time setting. So that training and experience is important. Also, sometimes just accepting your own mortality, and particularly in the tour that I did in 2007 when I was flying on the helicopter, and you know, one of the poems in the book is about that, Sangin Valley, which is a very high threat environment. You know, the medical helicopter was target number one, because if you affect the medical system, then you affect the soldier's will to fight. A high threat environment. So at lunchtime, I would go into the little tent serving lunch on the main camp, and I'd have burger and chips. And at dinner time, I'd go back into the tent, and if burger and chips was on the menu, I'd have it again. Because you're not thinking about your waistline. You're thinking about your soul. And
as I say, comfort, presumably, yes, familiarity.
Absolutely.
Anchors.
Well, it's just that your horizon is so low. Your horizon is so narrow. It's the next mission. It's the next 24 hours. It's not, do I remember to take my statin? Because there's something in 20 years, 30 years that might be important. You're just not thinking like that at all.
And the brain's not equipped to think that way, is it?
Yeah.
Under duress.
And then there's reflection. I mean, what I've always done, from those early days of career is if there was a clinical challenge, well, is the guideline right? Well, let's change the guideline. Let's write the new guideline. Let's write another paper. Where's the research requirement? Let's do the research. The equipment's wrong. Well, let's report it. And let's make sure that we get the right equipment coming out. So there's these sort of ways of driving the medical system. And what I found is that the military are extremely responsive and agile in a crisis. You know, if you want a train ticket with 6 weeks' notice to go from Birmingham to London, well, flipping heck, there's some forms to fill out. But if I want some kit in the middle of an operational setting tomorrow, well, that's a very different issue through a different chain of command, and away we go. You know, we are great in a crisis. We are very, very, very responsive.
Is that good for mental health and well-being in those kind of high pressure trauma situations? Because when there's a lot of stuff out of our control, sometimes then people can disengage, but focusing on the small things that are in your control is actually quite evidence-based in psychology.
Yeah. I might have been a little bit naughty because I would, as defense consultant advisor emergency medicine, so as the person who is driving forward the doctrine and the equipment and the guidelines for pre-hospital care and emergency medicine for 11 years and deploying most years, I would wait until I deployed to actually get some of the things sorted. Because it was so much easier to get sorted from the deployed setting. And it, you know, you could sort of hear the vibes come out. He's deployed again, hasn't he?
But I imagine in that situation, being able to go, I can control this, I can make this change, this is my reflection, this is what needs to happen. But actually, I'm just wondering what that did in terms of helping with potential trauma, compassion fatigue, even the, you know, kind of vicarious trauma, all of those things, that there are small little things that you were able to do to reflect on.
Yeah,
to get a little bit
you can see the thing is, you can see progress. And this is part of the positivity of the weekly clinical case conferences that, particularly when we're getting into Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yes.
Because before then, we were writing reports that were sort of 6 months in arrears, that you would look at the data retrospectively, you'd analyze it, you'd put a little paper report out and hope people would read it and maybe learn from it. But it wasn't changing people's practice in real time.
Yeah.
When we started to do the reporting on only a week in arrears, because everybody's at the next clinical conference hearing about the progress of the patients they've sent home and telling us about patients that are in the pipeline, then suddenly it's the people who are actually operating at the time getting the feedback. Say, oh, well, I'll change that. I'll change the way that I practice in order to accommodate that. And that's when we really got traction, because you're changing in near real time and actually influencing care during the period of that person's deployment.
Something to hold on to. And I presume as well, also hearing about how people have done that you supported, that, because actually, if you're in the field and you're not then necessarily knowing where people have gone or how they are, whether that
useful. Very useful. And then the, I suppose, the final way that I found of coping was with the poetry.
Yes.
Because it's a great way of reflecting. I think when you sit down and write a poem, although I tend to be able to write them quite quickly in an hour or two, I might fiddle with them a little bit later, but most of it will come out fairly quickly. You do think hard about the words. Yeah, you know, when you write narrative, you can type away quite quickly, but when you're writing poetry and it's got to scan, it's got to rhyme. You're thinking very carefully, what does that word mean? What is the right word to fit there? You'll think about the situation and that it is an accurate reflection. Because to me, the poems have been a reflection of the story. Now, it might include a frustration or a specific observation that I want to bring out, a certain message I want to give. But they are all events that happened, and they are all told as truthfully as I can in that that form. So to me, it's a little slice of social history. It's recorded that event. Allowed me to reflect on it. Now, most of the time, I just sort of did it and then moved on. And it was only years later when I thought, oh, I'll just put a couple of these in the National Army Museum exhibition or start talking about them, that I was encouraged to write the book and go back and pull them
That's
all together.
That's what I wondered, right, yes. The kind of that, what that story was. And is it all right to ask, did you write poetry as a child, in your before becoming a doctor, or was it
I didn't write it as a child, but I do remember even at primary school, when you had to do a sort of a show and tell or a bit of a performance, I would turn to Edward Lear's Nonsense Omnibus or something and learn the Owl and the Pussycat and recite it. So it sort of appealed to me.
It resonated with
that form.
Level.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And my mind is comfortable with rhyme and also with simplification. I'd like to take something complex and distill it down into something relatively simple. And I think the first published, well, I'm pretty certain the first published poems I did was in the Basics Journal, British Association for Immediate Care, would have been the early 1990s. And if you can imagine, you respond in pre-hospital care to a cardiac arrest. What you're having to remember is quite a complex algorithm, whether it's for ventricular fibrillation, asystole, pulseless electrical activity. What do I do? How do I remember this? Now, if you're in an emergency department, it would invariably be in a poster on the wall above the head of the patient where they're lying in the resuscitation room. You just look up at the poster and you know what the next step is, but not when you're out on your own in the mud and the rain, trying to remember what to do next. So I turned those algorithms into little rhymes. I called them rhythms in rhyme, and I had a rhyme each for those three major rest rhythms, and ventricular fibrillation was 200, 200, 360, then tube IV, adrenaline, 3 minutes CPR, and then 360 thrice and round again. So just a very simple sort of way of grounding yourself and right, what's
that.
Next then? And I suppose that was useful then, but the way that I've used poetry since, and certainly what's in that in the book, is more deep reflections on specifically difficult situations. So all my most difficult life situations are in the book in poem form. So they are accessible, and you can read through it in an afternoon. You can see it all. That's what's worked for me, and I've looked at various areas. So I've looked at some of the absurdities of the environment of war, if anybody remembers MASH, the Mobile Army Surgical Hospital sort of TV program of the 70s and 80s, MASH is not a parody, because far stranger things happen in the deployed field hospitals. So some of these sort of bizarre experiences and absurdities come out. Frustrations come out, reflections on serious injury and death, and also remembrance, that's really important that we remember that the sacrifice of our soldiers, sailors and airmen. So that comes out as a strong theme.
The thing that's really struck me as well is that, and I will bring this in, after being a psychologist for 25 years, there are some people where kind of traditional therapies just isn't for them, but also there can be stigma and shame about accessing kind of talking therapies. What I was really struck by, so I've kind of heard of bibliotherapy, I've heard of people, writing through poetry, prose, journaling, but we met at an event that was specifically around kind of poetry in medicine, and it was a whole range of people, people using it who've been through trauma just as a civilian, but also medics, and people like myself. We're all absorbing from the people that we work with kind of vicariously, aren't we? People like yourselves, you're on the front line for many, many years, is finding a way to process that trauma, not only to help your own well-being, but in order to be able to do your job and to carry on being innovative. Because trauma could massively affect cognition. It can affect, you know, it can make people risky. It can stop people from being able to do their jobs. And one thing that's really kind of struck me is the kind of stigma and shame around talking about mental health, particularly for men. So what I really love is your work bringing poetry out there, but also normalizing conversations about men processing emotions. I would love to bring this in because I still think there's some barriers there, that poetry is another fantastic way to be able to do that. Because what I also love is the autonomy and control of how and when you do it and what you're writing about and how long you spend on it. And to me, I love that flexibility. And if it's the right to say, because I've read through, there's some really not yep. all of it is about your military career in here. And no. One that really poem that really struck me as well was about the loss of both your parents during yes. COVID. That actually you don't
ask me to read that one though.
No, I won't ask you.
But that makes me choke up a bit.
It's what I really love is that you've been so vulnerable in sharing that as a medic, people may think that your work is just around processing trauma from your job. But actually, and I've started since that event last year when I met you and several other amazing people, some of which are also going to come on my podcast, is just how as professionals, we could use it in our personal lives as well as our professional lives. And it is hugely impacting reading words, writing words, connecting, giving that to me. Everyone needs to pick up this book. I will put it in the show notes and put a link to it as well. So it's Frontlines and Lifelines. But you also go around talking about this and you share some of your poems. There's nothing like hearing it being read by somebody. Yep. And one of the things you said is actually you've got a book festival coming up, haven't you? Did you want to tell us about where that is?
So I launched the book at the Edinburgh Fringe and that was great. But I'm at the Morpeth Book Festival on the 21st of March, which is a Saturday. We have an hour in the early evening, 6 o'clock till 7 o'clock, in the biggest venue, which is the church, because I've had a number of the poems also set to original music. Wow. So I've got an adult choir called the Wonny Line Choir who will be singing three of them. Two of them are quite funny, and one is really difficult. It is called We Are Here, and really it's a conversation between a soldier and his wife about suicide.
Yes.
So having a mixed choir can do those two parts. But I've also got the local school involved, the King Edward School. They're going to provide musicians to give the backing to a local teenager soloist who will sing The Black Snake. And The Black Snake is about that image of the hearses with flags draped over the coffins as they go through Wood and Bassett. I will finish with the hymn for Helmand, which the whole congregation, the whole of the attendees who are in the church can sing, with the choir helping to belt it out, and the church organist will play it. So it should really come out strongly. Yeah. And I have got set up a couple of student readers as well to do that. And in return, I'm doing a masterclass in poetry at the school.
Because that's what I also love, is that you do work not only just sharing, but how to help people on their journey using poetry to process. Gave me goosebumps just hearing about the event, let alone I find this very visceral, actually, poetry and medicine, using poetry to kind of process adversity, life. I find it very visceral. And I think for some people, that's a very accessible way to deal with stuff. And for some people that have had buried for year on year. We've got the book festival coming up. Where can people find you and your books? Because we'll make sure we get that in as well. If people want to find out more about you and the other books that you've written.
Crikey. Well, I don't have a website or anything like that. If you Google me, you can probably find stuff out about me. The book's on Amazon and other online stores. It is available online. But if you were to come to the book festival, then you'd have to have a ticket. It is Saturday the 21st of March at 6 o'clock, and it's running in St George's Church in the centre of Morpeth. Now all the royalties of book sales go to the Poppy Factory.
Yes.
Because I am a trustee of.
I'll put a link to that as well in the show notes, actually, because they were at the event, weren't they, that we were at.
Yeah, and the Poppy Factory is in its centenary year this year.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I have written a celebratory centenary poem. So I have kept writing some new stuff as well. It isn't just about reflections on what I experienced in my sort of deployed career. I'm writing contemporary stuff too.
Yes, yeah. But I think that's lovely for people to hear as well. If they meet you in person, they might get a signed copy. I'm not sharing mine. I'm keeping one.
You're holding it up there to show the cover. And yes. On the cover is a pair of boots.
I'll make sure I hold that.
Now
yes.
Those are my boots. They are my boots after I had been in the temporary mortuary. And they are covered in blood and soot, and the soot is, I'm afraid, charred skin. And the boots went in the bin.
Yeah.
But they've been painted by a war artist friend, Gordon Rushmer. And that image now hangs in the Imperial War Museum as the surgeon's boots.
I must make sure I go and see that. If there was one little nugget or little something that you could leave us, and now I'm hugging my book. If there is something you could leave us as one little reflection, one little takeaway, what might that be?
So, takeaway, and this is this the adversity takeaway or a general takeaway?
One, just a general, just something you would like to leave our listeners with, that maybe a next step. Following on from this, absolutely.
Right. Well, there's a couple of things that spring to me. One's on poetry. One's more widely. The takeaway for me is that poetry has been healing for me. It has been a genuine way of dealing with something difficult and be able to draw a box around it. Think, right, okay, I understand that. I've reflected on that. I know what I'm going to do as a result of that. Move on. To the next thing. So it has been a very good way for me to bound some of the issues I've dealt with. And then a general sort of takeaway from my career, and certainly dealing with crisis, is have a simple system and stick to it. Because that simple system, as I mentioned, it allows you to hurdle the cognitive paralysis and get you going. And it only needs to be a simple system, because once you've started, then you'll be okay. But you've got to have something that gets you over the first few minutes. People will be looking at you for advice and direction. So you have to have that sort of mental system to follow so that you can help others.
I'm going to take that back into my other work as well. Tim, thank you so much. I know, because you're an incredibly busy person, so I'm always so, so grateful when people take time out to come on. It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you for all you do. And then just personal thank you as well, because this book isn't just something I share in my professional capacity, but it's actually helped me as well a lot over the last year. So thank you so much. It's been an honour.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quintarillo, and it's been lovely having you along to listen to this episode. If you want to find more about me, you can find me at drtara.co.uk. So you'll see everything I'm up to, my media work, my collaborations, my clinical work, if you're interested in that. And of course, all the other episodes of the Adversity Psychologist podcast. If you're interested in coming on, you can also contact me and let me know what you would like to come and talk about. I'd love to hear from you.